Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Today we have a very special guest with a very special topic. Our guest today is Mega Award-winning journalist Robert Fisk. After this break, we'll be right back with Robert Fisk.
Since the beginning of time, mankind has waged war. Rarely has there ever been a noble cause for this slaughter. In 1935, between World War I and World War II, Major General Smedley Butler wrote a treatise from the perspective of a U.S. Marine career that spanned decades. This treatise was called War is a Racket. Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox and Piece of the Action have collaborated to publish the 75th anniversary edition. The U.S. military-industrial complex is still profiting while our young people are still killing and dying. The U.S. military-industrial complex commits massive resources to preying on our children, and we in the peace community must be proactive in stopping that. War is a Racket should be in every family home, school library, youth group, and peace group. Please go to www.warisaracket.net for ordering information. And follow us on Facebook at War is a Racket 75th Anniversary Edition.
Johnny, good luck to Johnny Canuck and all the... Robert Fisk, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. My first question is, what is the likelihood, or what do you think is the likelihood, that the U.S. or Israel, or the U.S. and Israel, will strike Iran's nuclear facilities soon?
My crystal ball is broken quite a long time ago. It's a fact that Obama, quite soon after he became president, sent some pretty important generals to Tel Aviv. That's where the Israeli Ministry of Defense is. It's not in Jerusalem. To tell them, look, don't attack Iran. You're on your own if you want to do it. But of course, they won't be on their own. If the Israelis attack Iran, the Iranians have said very specifically, and militarily it makes complete sense from their point of view, that they would attack U.S. forces in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the Gulf. And the reality is that Americans are still fighting in Iraq. I mean, they've got this 50,000 non-combat troops. They've already been in combat five times. They can't take on a third war. They can hardly handle two. So it's not in America's interest to have a war with Iran, but it may be in Israel's interest, and then we bring Americans in again and so on. The real issue is, do we really, really think that they're going to develop a nuclear missile or a nuclear arms? And if they do, does it matter? I mean, you know, if you live in the Middle East, as I do, it's quite clear that if you have a nuclear weapon, you won't get invaded. We're not planning to invade or bomb North Korea, for example, or Pakistan, because they've got a bomb. So it's quite logical for any Muslim power, for example, that if you want to prevent domination or invasion or attack by the West, get hold of a nuclear bomb, even just one. And anyway, it's not crackpots like Ahmadinejad, the quote president unquote of Iran, who control nuclear weapons. It's much more serious people. And the idea that Iran is going to use them to destroy Israel and the whole of Palestine as well, and then get destroyed itself, is pretty ridiculous, I think. That danger is out there. One of the things we do have to remember, it shouldn't be exaggerated, but it shouldn't be forgotten, is that we do have the most right-wing Israeli government in power at the moment. And people like Lieberman, the foreign minister, I mean, I put them in the same crackpot box as Ahmadinejad or Gaddafi. So these are not, you know, just as we have some pretty odd characters in Tehran, we've got some very odd characters in Jerusalem. Can we rely upon them for what we like to call common sense, a very Western expression? I don't know. Of course, not only would Israel bring in the Americans if it attacked Iran, I think it would be very odd if the Hezbollah, I mean, forget Hamas and their tin pot rockets, if Hezbollah did not respond in southern Lebanon. Then, of course, you're going to have a war involving Shiites and the Americans. In Iraq it's the Sunnis, and largely in Afghanistan it's the Sunnis. Now you're going to bring in the Shiites as well. But, you know, all along, one of the problems here is that there is this kind of, I mean, I come backwards and forwards to America all the time, sometimes 14 times in a year. And somewhere over the Atlantic, I fly through this sort of screen. And when I land in Washington or San Francisco, wherever, the Middle East is not the place I live in anymore. It's some fantasy world which people here talk about and don't really seem to have much knowledge of. The people who live there know about their own history, of course. We don't. And so decisions taken in Washington about Iran and decisions taken in Tehran about Washington are often very weirdly out of sync. The Iranians actually understand us much better than we understand them, but that won't stop an attack on Iran. I rather think there will not be. But then again, I've twice been wrong about the 14 wars I've covered in the Middle East, but the other 12 times I got it right. So I don't think there will be at the moment. That's my feeling. But as I said, my crystal ball is in little glass pieces all over the floor.
Robert, do you think there's more of a likelihood of a war between Israel and Hezbollah in the near future?
I had the dubious pleasure of being present and in the last Hezbollah Israeli war in 2006. And it ended, of course, with the Israelis. Oh, it ended with George Bush claiming the Israelis had won, which was another fantasy. The Israelis, no, they didn't win. They were humiliated. Their armor was blown to pieces in Lebanon. Their soldiers were shot down. They couldn't defend their own cities. The Hezbollah claimed it was a divine victory. While I was on the roads of southern Lebanon, it didn't feel very much like a divine victory or any other kind to me. But clearly the Israelis lost. I'm not sure the Hezbollah won, but the Israelis lost. When I talk to Hezbollah now, and I talk to Hezbollah fighters in the south, not just leadership people who are put in front of TV cameras, they clearly are looking forward to a second round to convince the world they really did win last time. And when I was in Israel a few weeks ago, I went to the Herzliya conference, which is where all the Israeli political right meet and give long speeches. I flew into Israel and went to the Herzliya conference and reported on it and met a lot of the people who pop up on my TV screen in Beirut raging about Lebanon. And I came away with a distinct impression, especially after listening to the deputy chief of staff of the IDF, the Israeli army, talking about Lebanon, of which he seemed to have very little political grasp. I came away with a distinct feeling the Israelis want to repair their shattered image from 2006 and have another go at Hezbollah. One of the things we have to remember in all these various Israeli-Arab wars is that the Israeli army has actually performed lamentably for decades now. They haven't won a war in 37 years. 1973 was the last real victory the Israelis won. The invasion of Lebanon in 1978 was it petered out in long and bloody occupation. 82 was a disaster. That's when we had Sabra Shatila massacre. The 1993 bombardment was hopeless. 96 ended in the Kana massacre. 2006 ended in another massacre in Kana and massive casualties. But I think the Israelis want another go, and I think the Hezbollah want another go. And I fear, of course, as usual, there's two things that will happen if that does take place. The civilian casualties will be grossly disproportionate. Vast areas of Lebanon will be destroyed, infrastructure, roads, and of course rebuilt afterwards. And the State Department, and I absolutely promise you this, the State Department will call on both sides to exercise restraint, and both sides will know that they're lying. And the Israelis will tell the Americans to get offside until they end up with another massacre or tragedy, and then they'll be pleading for a UN ceasefire, and then the old UN donkey will clip-clop in over the corpses and the rubble, and we'll have another ceasefire until the next war, and that's how it goes on. If that seems cynical, it's because I live there.
Well, since you do live in the region, what do you think the implications are for the recent massive arms sale to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates from the United States?
Well, it's laughable. I mean, we all know who live in the region that the Saudis can't use all this equipment. I mean, $60 billion. Funny, I slipped it into my file. I don't use Googles and internets. I have real paper and books. And I slipped it into my arms file, and out popped another clipping from 12 years ago saying America was going to sell $60 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia. I go to Saudi Arabia. You can see this stuff lying with, sheets over it so that sand doesn't get in the works. And by and large, the Saudis can't use all this equipment. It has to be used by the Americans or some other, air force that's brought in to, practice on it. But it's a prestige thing. And of course, part of the relationship of the Saudis is to the Americans, you protect us, we'll buy your weapons, we'll keep you solvent. Not quite apart from the oil, and that's how the system works. It's totally corrupt. It helps nobody. It does not help the Saudi population. Certainly doesn't help the Iranians, whom they think they're defending themselves against, or who we have to persuade them that they are. It helps the American arms manufacturers. It helps the economy of the weapons manufacturers. Not much else here. But that's the way the system works. You know, it's one of the awful cliches that what has become a cliche, the famous Eisenhower comment on the military-industrial complex, is correct and remains correct. Although, you know, like Chomsky's manufacture of consent, it's become so true that nobody remembers it anymore.
What do you think will be the outcome of the peace talks between the U.S., Israel, and Palestine?
First of all, we were told this latest meeting with, you know, Clinton and Obama and Mahmoud Abbas and Netanyahu and heaven spare us, Blair as well. 5 to 11, the last chance of peace, etc. If it was so important, why wasn't it held 2 months ago or 5 months ago? Why now? Well, because of the midterm elections. This is another bit of electioneering ploy. And as usual, the Arabs and Israelis are trotted out to play their role in the theater. And then later they'll be put to one side and there'll be another war and they'll say, how did it happen? And so on and so forth. No long-term planning. You know, those days are gone. If you go to the West Bank, I say I was in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza a few weeks ago, it's perfectly obvious that there is no chance of there being a Palestinian state. There will be a one-state solution, and the state, I think, will be called Israel. And those Palestinians who remain within the borders of that state, which will stretch from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, Jordan River, I mean, they will either despair and leave and go to Syria or Europe or San Francisco or Washington, or they'll stay and be the Gastarbeiter, you know, the guest workers for the Israelis. You see, the key is what is known as Area C. Under the Oslo Agreement, Area C comprises approximately 62% of the West Bank, the putative Palestinian state, quote-unquote. And in this area, Israel has full occupational control. Other areas, there's shared responsibilities. And in one or two particular cities, like Ramallah, the Palestinians are, in theory, unless the Israelis happen to stage a raid, in control. But Area C is effectively now annexed off to Israel. When I went there, for example, quite apart from the fact that Jewish colonies, which they are, forget the word settlements, continued to expand, to thicken inside. And I was actually traveling with Amira Haas, who, of course, is the very honorable and fine Israeli journalist for Haaretz. All the villages we went to, the Palestinian Mukhtars met us, and there was lots of cups of tea. And then they produced this huge file of documents from the Israeli occupation authorities in Hebrew, signed, although the signatures were illegible, saying that this man cannot build another story in his house, and if he does, his house will be destroyed. This man cannot build another story. So the families can't expand, they can't get married, therefore, of course, they'll go to Jordan or Lebanon or somewhere else. One of the most weirdest laws is that the Palestinians in these villages in Area C, 62% of the West Bank, cannot dig more than 3 inches into the ground. Now, this is an obvious problem because not only then can they not operate sewage or water, but they can't put up electricity poles because you can't put a pole 3 inches in the ground and fall over. So what they've done is they've got these huge concrete blocks and laid them on the earth and then stuck the electricity pole into the concrete block. Now, how long do you keep hanging on in the face of this kind of what is clear, not just harassment, it's oppression? And, you know, when you talk to the Israelis at the checkpoint, they acknowledge, yes, they're not allowed to dig more than 3 inches in case they put a bomb in the ground, you know. So clearly, Area C, 62% of the West Bank, cannot be inside a Palestinian state. This means that, as opposed to what we believe, which is that Mahmoud Abbas is generously being allowed to negotiate for 22% of Mandate Palestine, the original Palestine when the Brits were there, he's actually negotiating for about 10.8 or 10.9% of Mandate Palestine. And that ain't no state. It's not viable. It's not workable. It's not secure. It can't work. So I think, you know, the problem is that public opinion, partly because of us journalists and our endless waffling about peace process, it never was a process anyway, they still believe there's hope, there's light at the end of the tunnel, all the usual cliches. It's gone. Palestine's gone. And there isn't going to be, I don't believe it's going to be a Palestinian state. I think there will be one state and it will be called Israel. And the project will thus be completed. Now, whether in the long term you can hold on to it or not, you know, I meet Jewish Americans, particularly in California, but also in other parts of America, who obviously they say, quite frankly, look, you know, this Middle Eastern thing is a project, Zionist, Israeli, call it what you want, which may or may not work. For them, security is here. I mean, if I was a Jewish American, I would stay in America. And I say that only because a lot of Jewish Americans tell me that's their choice too. But, you know, the idea that Israel's going to, even if it does, effectively take all the Arab land, which militarily it has anyway, the idea that it's going to survive indefinitely, well, we don't know. Everything at the end of the day depends on the relationship with the United States. And as long as America gives its unconditional, uncritical support for Israel, right or wrong, there will be no peace. And that, of course, is a danger not just for the Arabs, but for the Israelis as well. There are, of course, plenty of Israelis who believe that this constant colonial expansion is going to destroy their home. I think they're right in saying that. I think, but of course, they're not necessarily a majority. One of the problems you have, you know, as a journalist who goes in and out of Israel, I mean, I go to Israel from Lebanon, but via Jordan or Cyprus, is that when I arrive, you know, you go to Tel Aviv, which is a very European city, and lovely restaurants, good music. I go to the art gallery. I mean, I appreciate lots of things about Israeli culture and society. And, of course, I go and seek out all those nice lefties and liberal Israelis who say about Israel the kind of things that I want to hear said about Israel. But when I get on the bus up to Jerusalem, I don't hear the same voices. There are settlers, there are Israelis who are not actually particularly, you know, highly educated even. They've been immigrants from Russia, they haven't yet learned Hebrew very well. And their views on the Arabs are pretty much what you'd hear from Hamas about the Israelis, you know. And so, you know, it comes down to the old question, which countless books are written about, what is this country, Israel? You know, who lives in it? Who are these people? And Israelis ask this question all the time, and their newspapers are preoccupied with this, and rightly so, actually. But when you have a country and this crazy political system, I mean, poor old Israelis to have this proportional representation, constantly producing these crazed minority governments, you know, I don't know, in this country with all these nuclear weapons, you know. I don't know, it's a pretty sorry situation, and I don't know. You know, I get up every morning in Beirut and I hear see the palm trees swaying outside my bedroom, and I hear the Mediterranean sloshing below my balcony until the cars come and start hooting. And I wait, you know, where is the explosion today, I ask myself. But the most dangerous thing at the moment, the most dangerous thing, is that our masters and leaders, you know, the Obamas or the Bushes or the Blairs, the, you know, David Camerons, they're still promoting this total fantasy that there can be a peace in the Middle East. And there isn't going to be. If we continue on this path, there is going to be continual war. And as we've seen since World War II in the Middle East, the wars have got steadily wider, bigger, worse, entangling more and more countries, now involving directly, of course, since 9/11, the United States, actually since before 9/11. The days when we can go on colonial adventures and sit happily at home in Denver or Gloucestershire are gone. But we don't realize that. Still, we don't realize that.
You've called President Ahmadinejad of Iran a crackpot. What do you think about Hamas?
I have a very cynical view of Hamas because they're a very cynical organization. They're very arrogant. You see, first of all, let's, you know, run the narrative of history through from the beginning. In 2006, the Palestinians were urged to have a democratic election. George Bush said, wonderful, have a democracy. So the Palestinians went to vote, and those pesky Palestinians voted for the wrong people. They voted for Hamas. They didn't vote for Hamas because they wanted an Islamic Republic. They voted for Hamas because they were sick and tired of the corruption of Mahmoud Abbas and Arafat, and the whole, Arafat's gone, but the whole Palestinian corrupt old fogies from Fatah. I mean, I brought it home to me once. I was in Jerusalem and I got a call from Fatah. You know, one of our officials, his home has been shelled by an Israeli tank. Rushed down in my car from Jerusalem. There was the house, there was the hole, and there was the Israeli tank. But what struck me when I went into the house amid the rubble was all these gold-plated taps in the bathroom. There was the story. You don't vote for people like that. You vote for people who are clean, right? Anyway, then 2007, Hamas take over, very bloodily, the Gaza Strip. And they then will not conform to the Oslo Agreement. Their argument, of course, which was quite logical, was, well, the Israelis haven't conformed. You know, they've been renegotiating Oslo, Y and Y River and all these other places for a long time. But of course, Hamas are not going to start off by acknowledging everything that Arafat did and then becoming the PLO or the Palestinian Authority. But they've got very big heads. You know, it's a very corrupt organization, Hamas. They think they're the Hezbollah of the South. They're not. They're nothing like Hezbollah. I remember one day there was this big funeral in Gaza and all the Palestinians were shooting in the air. And I was sitting watching this with a Hezbollah fighter in Lebanon. And I said, Ya Hussein, what do you think of this? He said, well, we sympathize with them because of their martyrs. But why do they waste all this ammunition? You know, it was a very interesting example of what happens when you have a very professional guerrilla army as opposed to this ragtag bunch in Gaza. Then you see, you've got to remember certain other things. Why are they really firing all these stupid tin pot missiles into Israel to provoke an assault? Okay, you can provoke an assault if you can then fight the Israelis. But they couldn't fight the Israelis. You know, they killed at least 35 Palestinian alleged collaborators, but only killed 13 Israelis, of whom two were Arab Israelis, by the way. And then they lost 1,300 of their own people, most of them civilians. That is not a great victory. I mean, Hezbollah were very, very cynical, and rightly so, about Hamas's performance. They were arrogant, they thought they could beat the Israelis, and they ran away. The Israelis didn't find their missing soldier, so he was hidden somewhere, well. But Hamas, I know the other thing, I mean, I go down these tunnels, I've been down, one of them's got a railway line in, the tunnels that go to Egypt. And Egypt, of course, is playing the colonial role of doing what the masters want as well by sealing off Gaza. But these tunnels, Hamas takes a cut on the profits of at least 5 million a year. Some people put that, quadruple it, put it into a $500 million a year. And they need that money. The word I hear in Gaza, everybody profits. The Egyptians profit. There are backhanders to the Israelis to make sure they don't actually bomb all the tunnels because you've got to keep some of them open. And so there's this, the whole tunnel system is a massive financial scam. And Hamas holds the tap on it. The reason I think why Hamas turns back food when it does come from Israel is because it's upsetting their scam on the tunnels. They're losing taxation, you see. So it's okay. You can bring a few weapons through. You can bring donkeys and paint them as tigers or whatever you want to do at the zoo. But at the end of the day, Hamas is a totally compromised and very corrupt organization. It's not the massive terroristic monster that Israel makes it out to be. I mean, Israel, you know, I was in Gaza when Arafat was still poncing around in Beirut, pretending to be the center of Arab nationalism. And I was actually present when the Israeli Gaza commander, because they had a military base in Gaza, then a big one, was negotiating with Hamas inside a mosque in which I was present, and encouraging Hamas to build more mosques in Gaza as a counterbalance to the horrible super terrorist Arafat who was up in Beirut. Then, of course, as we know, the super terrorist turned out to be a super statesman and went to the White House. And the nice Hamas mosques were full of super terrorists who'd been talking to the Israelis. You know, in 1992, 93, the Israelis expelled hundreds of Palestinians into Lebanon. And they were stuck on the border. The Lebanese wouldn't let them in. And it's a very funny incident there when I used to go down and talk to them every few weeks, you know, see how they were doing. It's very cold. They were living in tents. And one day I went down there and I mentioned to them that I was going to Israel the next day, via Cyprus on this occasion. And one of them got up, big bearded man, rushed off to a tent and came back. He said, Mr. Robert, would you like Perez's home telephone number, you see? And I said, yes. So I took it down. And it was his home telephone number. So here you go. Here are the elite of Israeli political society, obviously talking directly to these Hamas men who were being abused on Israeli radio as the worst kind of terrorists in the history of the world. And, of course, one of the things you must realize is all these people talk to each other. Hamas talks to the Israelis talk to Hamas, the Israelis talk to the Syrian Secret Service directly, not just through Turkey and so on. But, of course, the newspaper version is that, you know, little Israel is fighting this vast sea of terrorism and so on. It's not like that. But this is a good story. It's easy. It's not controversial. And journalists, you know, they can get away with it. So they do.
You've lived in the Middle East for at least 30 years. What keeps you going in that part of the world?
I suppose observing the folly of mankind is not a... it's a difficult thing to shake off. It's not like an addiction, but one does, you know, I can turn on Al Jazeera or even occasionally the BBC and hear the latest statements from Bush or Obama or Blair. And they are so outrageous that it's almost like a comedy theater to listen to it. A smile does cross my face. But if you want to know why I really do it, I mean, I was 29 when I went to the Middle East. I'm 64 now, and I'm still doing the same job living in the same house, almost the same salary. I suppose the answer really is a bit like reading a great historical novel. You know, you're reading War and Peace, Battle of Borodino, what will happen to Pierre, and so on. And you're reading late at night in bed, and you say, well, it's almost midnight, I'll just finish the chapter. And then you find yourself reading the next chapter, and then you say, well, just finish the next chapter. And before you know, you look up and you see the sunlight coming through the curtain as it's dawn. You've read all through the night, because you want to know what happens next, you see. And I think that probably is why I still work as a journalist in the Middle East. I want to know what happens next. It won't be nice, but I'm just desperate to see what happens next in this path of human folly, you know.
We're making a documentary about Venezuela and the demonization of President Chavez and his Bolivarian Revolution. And you've seen demonization of Arab countries and Arab leaders. And it correlates to what's happening in South America. What do you think the U.S. should be doing in the Middle East?
Look, one of the themes of modern Middle Eastern history is that if you want to be a surviving dictator, you've got to work for us. Mubarak, King Hussein, little King Abdullah, plucky little King Mark II, King of Morocco, President of Algeria, Gaddafi now. And if, you know, if you invade the right countries, like Iran, 1980, we'll support the dictator. We don't call him a dictator, we call him a pro-Western strong man on the APY. And then if you invade the wrong country, like Kuwait, then we'll biff them. When King Idris was overthrown by Gaddafi, the British Foreign Office wholeheartedly supported this fine young army colonel called Muammar Gaddafi. We loved him. Then he got involved with the IRA, then he was involved in bombing a Berlin nightclub, so we biffed him too and had to bomb him. Then he said he was giving up, you know, nuclear weapons, even though the average Libyan doesn't seem to be able to repair a lavatory in a Tripoli hotel. And we love him again, even though he's just as much a crackpot as Ahmadinejad and Lieberman of Israel and all the rest. So we switch on the bestiality system when these people don't obey. And usually the reason they don't obey, Nasser, for example, at the time of the nationalization of Suez, Saddam, Kuwait, and so on, is when they've donned the clothes of nationalism, have said that they now speak for the Arab people, or the Venezuelan people in the case of Chavez, then that gets very dangerous because we're the people in the West who decide who runs these countries and how they behave. Egypt's a good example because it's always been obedient. Sadat crossed the canal, but he actually did it rather well, and afterwards he wanted peace, so that was okay with Israel. But the bestialization is easy to switch on and off, and usually you use World War II. You know, Saddam became the Hitler of the Tigris. Anthony Eden called Nasser the Mussolini of the Nile in 1956 during the Suez War. And I know the same comments have been made about Chavez as well. And always when semi-dictators or slightly odd people, and Chavez is a bit odd, we have to admit this, decide that they're going to do what the people want rather than what the West wants, then we'll surround them and threaten them. And that, of course, builds up their stature even more and then projects them onto a world stage so they become friends of, you know, Ahmadinejad and Gaddafi and have sort of world crackpot summit forum, which, alas, I sometimes have to cover as a journalist. But, I mean, there's no doubt that American policy in general is fairly straightforward. You have your set of dictators, and if they step out of line, you bash them over the head and hope that they stop doing it. If they don't, you'll depose them, and they'll end up hanged like Saddam. But that's basically, I think, what American policy is, if you strip it down and look at it from the other point of view. But again, you see, we're not talking about the most important issue, which is, of course, oil and control of oil. And control of oil doesn't mean owning it or even owning the rights to explore reserves. It means ensuring for the foreseeable future, i.e. eternity, that the flow of oil continues at current or future necessary rates. And that, of course, is what Iraq was about. I mean, people can say it was about democracy, it was weapons of mass destruction, getting rid of Saddam. At the end of the day, however awful Saddam was, if the main national export product of Iraq was asparagus or potatoes, the 82nd Airborne would not have gone to Baghdad, and that is a fact.
What about Afghanistan? Why is the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan?
Because major superpowers want to be destroyed in Afghanistan, so they always go there and they always get destroyed. The British did it in 1842, they did it again in 1878, we almost did it in 1919, Russians did it in 1979, got thrown out in 88, and then we came up in 2001. Poor old Afghans, you know, I keep saying poor old Afghans. Why are we in Afghanistan? Preposterous. Human folly. Well, you know, you can look and search and say, well, you know, gas pipelines from the former Soviet Muslim republics to Pakistan, etc., etc. I think there's a bit more than this. You see, it's not just about sort of immediate post 9/11 anger over Al Qaeda, and therefore, you know, there was a very odd way in which Taliban had to be destroyed because they wouldn't give us bin Laden. Although for a period they might have avoided destruction, and we would have turned our back on burqas and women's rights and gender equality and all this other projects which we have. And indeed, we know at one point the Taliban were being courted in Houston, of all places, because we wanted them to be involved in this wonderful gas project which would bring so much happiness and prosperity to Afghanistan. I think in the end we went there because you are an empire, and we were an empire, and Knight still, you know, the lion still has a few, you know, whiskers. And the same applies very much in Iraq, as well as the oil and the fantasy and Israel. Empires have to project power. If they're bitten by a mosquito, they must kill the mosquito and smash their fists so hard there are no more mosquitoes afterwards. And the projection of power is the lifeblood of empires. The Romans did it. The Romans did it more wisely because they regarded everyone outside their borders as being barbarians, which is what we do, you know, the Taliban, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Al-Qaeda. But once they grabbed the country, they made all the people citizens of Rome. I once tried to explain to a CIA officer in Kufa in Iraq that if the Americans had come to Iraq and offered all the Iraqis the US passports, there'd have been no insurgency. The Iraqis wouldn't have flooded into JFK. They would have said, my goodness, the Americans really do love us. That'd be the end. But, of course, that wasn't going to be a policy that commended itself to the Bush administration or, indeed, to Mr. Blair, because we don't love them. We don't even care about them. The Romans at least went through the motions. I'm not recommending crucifixion here, but, you know, empires work this way. I remember once south of, this is going to Iraq, south of Baghdad, I was investigating the murder of some Red Cross drivers. I was talking to an Iraqi family whom I think saw the murder on the horrible throat-cutting Highway 8, and the ground started to tremble, and up the road, it was one of these roulements, these big brigade turnovers, you know, largest since World War II, and up the road came this unstoppable, never-ending, hour after hour convoy of, you know, M1, A1, Abrams tanks, Bradley fighting armored vehicles, truck after truck, all the soldiers, you know, with their rifles pointed out, like porcupine quills and shades in their eyes, all these Apache helicopters over the top. And I remember I sat on the side of the road with this poor Iraqi family who was so dumbstruck at this and thinking that, you know, 2,000 years ago, if I'd been a reporter, I would have been a little bit more to the west in Lebanon and it would have been the tramp of Roman legions I would have heard coming endlessly past me on the road. We can go to Baghdad. So we will go to Baghdad and we will send our armies through the lands of Samarra where civilization began, you see. That is what empires are real. They breathe, you know, they're very dangerous things too, like governments. And I think that in a way, Afghanistan beckons in this poisonous way to empires to go and show that they breathe, you see. And we have surges now. Well, surges just means reinforcements because we're losing, but we build it up into this massive tsunami, like unstoppable force, like spikes in violence. Well, it goes up and it comes down again. We mean it increases in violence and they're not going down. That's the whole problem. But there you go. I think it's about oil in Iraq. I think it's about empire in Iraq and Afghanistan and who knows in Iran or in Venezuela. And I don't know how you switch it off. Historically, there have been foreign invaders or economic collapse. I did Roman history and classics for my first degree along with linguistics. And I still read about Fall of the Roman Empire, not the movie of Hollywood version. And it's true that the Goths and Ostrogoths and Visigoths, you know, did a lot of invading of Roman territory, but it was the Roman economy that brought it down. It collapsed in basically valueless products. And then, you know, the postal system didn't work so well and the bread didn't arrive from Lebanon. And, so that's also worth bearing in mind. It was, after all, the final death of the British Empire was basically the end of the Second World War when Britain was bankrupt and the Americans said, okay, it's the end of Lend-Lease. We'd like the money now, please. The idea that empires collapse because of, you know, bearded men who get into the country on, you know, visas issued by the CIA, or because, you know, their soldiers get beaten in Afghanistan, which, like, you know, Vietnam does have a very critical point. At the moment, the situation is that America and Britain are not losing sufficient numbers to have the kind of serious effect it might otherwise have in the country. I mean, it's nothing like Vietnam casualties. And, I mean, I'm very struck when I'm in America, for example, that, you know, I see in the paper every day, New York Times, Chronicle, LA Times, you know, the little list of dead, you know, specialist so-and-so, age 24, age 22. And it's almost like it's the people killed in the storm, although the flash flood last night, it's like it's a natural phenomenon now, because it's not big enough to make an effect.
Tell my listeners the story you told me about Chavez and the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah.
What was particularly funny, it was funny at the time, is that when the Israeli bombardment ended of southern Lebanon, with actually flooding the country with cluster bomblets, we went into the villages, some of which were virtually razed. They were just heaps of rubble, and they stank because there were lots of civilians dead under the rubble. But where the Mukhtar had survived, and there were a few wounded Hezbollah lying around in the streets too, but where the Mukhtars, the village leaders, had survived, you know, Fisk would always rush up and say, so what do you think of the situation, you know? And they would proclaim their, you know, everlasting love of the Hezbollah. And I said, well, you know, do you like Nasrallah, the leader of the Hezbollah? And they'd always say, we like two people. We like Nasrallah and we like Chavez, you see. I was actually with a Washington Post reporter who was doubled up with laughter each time. They all said this and they hadn't been prompted. They actually believed this. And I said, why, to one of them. I can't remember the name of the place, Rehan, I think. I said to this guy, why do you like Chavez? He said, because he is like Nasrallah. He really makes Bush angry.
While we were in Venezuela, we interviewed one of the deputy foreign ministers, Tamir Poras, and I asked him if he thought that the U.S. empire would collapse probably sooner than later. His answer was, I hope so. What are your thoughts on that?
One of the things we don't think enough about is that America could, if it wanted to, be a great source of strength and goodness in the Middle East, if it would get rid of its obsessions about democracy, about Israel, and actually treat everyone with the same fairness, including the Israelis. You've got to remember that at the end of the First World War, which was partly fought to destroy the Ottoman Empire, you still had a vast stretch of land from the Mesopotamian Persian border, Iraq and Iran today, all the way to the Atlantic. And many U.S. Service officers in the State Department, who were, you know, consuls to the dying Ottoman Empire, places like Beirut, Tripoli, Constantinople, they were all petitioning the State Department, as were the NGOs, American NGOs, they were missionaries then, to have one modern Arab nation that would become a democracy like the democracies of Europe, and which the West would put all its treasure and financial and medical help, not military, but all its economic power to bring into being. One Arab nation united as a democracy. And well, Wilson died. Isolationism set in Congress and the House. And of course, the British and French had already chopped up the Middle East for themselves under the Sykes-Picot Agreement and produced this wonderful, glorious success story which exists today. But there was a moment when, and you know, amazingly, Arabs, quite apart from Israelis, still have this buried hope in America. That's why Obama got away with his initial months of saying we're reaching out to the Muslim world. They actually believed it all over again. After all the evidence, they believed it. I went to see Obama in Cairo when he spoke. And it's funny, if you see these guys, as opposed to just watch them on a flat screen TV, you pay more attention to their words. And there were lots of tripwires in his speech. The relocation of the Palestinians in 48, like they got up in the morning and said, oh, let's go to Lebanon, you know. So Hart was in the right place. And, of course, the Arab elites wanted this to work. It was very interesting. When he spoke at Cairo University, which I got into, The Egyptians present were all members of the sort of pro-regime, pro-American, upper-middle-class elite of society. There was nobody there who was going to be shouting Islamic statements to Mr. Obama. And, of course, it wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen.
That was Robert Fisk, award-winning journalist. We sat down with Robert in Berkeley when he was here for a talk, and I'd like to thank Mecca for Peace and the Fresno Center for Nonviolence for helping us to arrange this interview. Well, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to also thank my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, Joshua Smith for putting this interview together for us, and you for listening. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I hope you tune in again next week. Thank you.